Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Guillermo Amaral joins me. We're going to be talking about JavaScript, specifically Node.js and NPM, the package manager for it. You're probably using this already, so you're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Guillermo Amaral, episode 435, recorded May 23rd, 2017, NPM. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Cloudflare. More than 6 million websites, apps, APIs, and SaaS companies use Cloudflare services to weather whatever the internet throws at them. For a free online chat session with a Cloudflare support engineer, visit cloudflare.com/twit. And by GoCD, an on-premise open-source continuous delivery server by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you complete control of and visibility into your deployments across multiple teams. Since GoCD is open-source, you can download and use it for free. To discover the power of their pipelines, visit gocd.io/twit. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneEdge.com, bringing you each week the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, projects you may be using every day, and maybe you're aware of it or not. I think today's you might be aware of if you're using it every day, or projects you might just want to find out about more and download after the show. So joining me today is back once again, Guillermo Amaral. Welcome back to the show.
Yo, Randall, how's it going?
I think we're going okay. I think I'm back in the saddle here. Running a show. I'm back in Beaverton again, back home. I've been out and about between last week's show and this week's show. In fact, Guillermo, I was just down the street from you, and I just realized I hadn't called you to say hi. So forgive me, please. Next time,
no, when I come back okay, in 6 weeks.
Yeah, it's fine. And you're speaking to us, and the reason I'm referring to that is you're speaking to us from your secret above ground bunker.
We don't have any fancy names here.
Well, there is Zona Rio and there's Zona Centro. I know about those. Zona Centro is where the famous Caesar's restaurant is, the one that invented the Caesar salad. And I actually ate there once this past weekend and had a wonderful Caesar salad. If you watch my Flickr feed or my Twitter feed, you saw me taking pictures of an authentic Caesar salad made right there in front of me with all the really good fixes. But this show is not about this or that or the other. This show is about open source software. This show is about wonderful things. This week, absolutely no exception to that. We have a really interesting project today, and it's essential for many, many tens and maybe hundreds of thousands of people who are programming in JavaScript. It's called NPM, the Node.js Package Manager. And we have on the show today, we have Isaac, I forgot to ask him how to pronounce it. Isaac, I'm going to ruin it, Schloter, something close to that. You can correct me when you come on in a minute if I get it wrong. And he's the inventor of NPM, but he's also been heavily participating in the Node.js itself. So we're going to kind of have a sort of a dual mode show, more about NPM, but a lot about what Node.js is and what it provides to us. And why we need something like NPM to go on top of that. But the key word here is JavaScript. This is all about managing JavaScript packages so that you can build it for server-side applications using Node.js, but also client-side applications for things that are downloaded into the browser. And since JavaScript is the one language to rule them all at this point, until Dart gets a little more popular, this has definitely been an essential thing. Node.js also has, it's been managing lots and lots of packages. At last count, when I looked, 475,000-ish building blocks that are available for you to use and reuse in your projects. I like to compare that a bit to the CPAN, which is the Perl's equivalent of this. This has been around actually for a lot longer, 22, 23 years. And there's still, I thought the numbers would be much further apart, but the CPAN currently has 185,000 packages available for use. So, you know, Perl's been around. Perl's, you know, the CPAN was a big thing, but apparently JavaScript swooped right by it as everybody wanted to play with that. And also just for comparison, there's only 2,600 packages in the Dart repository that is equivalent to this, but they're gaining a ton more soon. So what do you know about this, Guillermo?
I think you just covered everything I knew. I was going to say, isn't this the CPAN of JavaScript?
I think you're too late. You're too late to say that.
That's fine.
You're
too late. That's okay.
Okay. And we will bring on our guest in just a moment, but I do have an important message before we do that, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Cloudflare. Cloudflare is on a mission to build a better internet. Cloudflare makes your site or app faster, safer, and more reliable, so you can stop worrying about slow loading page times, downtime, or getting hacked. Cloudflare is incredibly easy to use, and sign up takes less than 5 minutes. Cloudflare's global network of 115 plus data centers caches your content and moves it closer to visitors. Their web optimization features speed up your code and make it mobile responsive. End-to-end, Cloudflare speeds up every request to your site with performant DNS, caching, content optimization, load balancing, and more. Cloudflare doesn't only provide DDoS protection, their web application firewall is powered by a massive IP reputation that updates for all users. Cloudflare's 24/7 security team is constantly watching for new vulnerabilities and deploying real-time protection. So no matter what you choose for your cloud compute, AWS, Azure, Google Cloud, a combination of public and hybrid, Cloudflare works with all of them. Using Cloudflare gives your business the option to use more than one cloud provider, so you don't get locked in to any of them. If you're hit with a DDoS attack, or if your site suddenly experiences a surge in illegitimate traffic, you pay the same amount, and plans range from free, $20 a month, $200 a month, and custom plans for enterprise. So Cloudflare is offering Twit listeners a free online chat session with one of their top support engineers to answer any of your questions. Visit cloudflare.com/twit to sign up today. That's cloudflare.com/twit. And we thank Cloudflare for their support of Floss Weekly. Now let's go on with the show here. So we're going to bring on Isaac Schlitter. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Just to start, my name is pronounced Schluter.
Schluter.
So you're close.
Okay.
Schluter. Probably overthinking it a little bit.
I could be. It could be. Yes. it's like that. And where are you speaking to us from?
I'm calling from our office in Oakland, the PM Inc. office.
Oh, cool. I think I flew right over there as I was heading LA to Portland yesterday. So I didn't wave at you because I didn't know you were right down there below me, but that's okay. So give us the 30,000 foot view. How did Node.js get started, and how did NPM sort of enhance all that and make what we now have today as being one of the biggest, well, the biggest repositories for language-based software in the world?
So that's a big question. So Node started, I think it was kind of, it was the right time and place in history for server-side JS to happen. There were a bunch of people sort of involved with trying to get JavaScript on the server to be a thing that people would actually want to use. Ryan Dahl, around the same time, was trying to figure out a better way to make HTTP web servers. He had been building servers in Ruby and in C, and just kind of came to this idea that asynchronous I/O was a better way to build web servers, and figured, well, every language has a built-in I/O paradigm sort of baked into the language itself. If you look at like Perl or Python or Ruby, they all do synchronous I/O as part of the standard library. Now, there were things that were sort of built as add-ons onto that, like binding any event in Perl or event machine in Ruby, and there was a few others. There was
it's twisted,
a bunch in Python.
Twisted, isn't it, in Python?
Yeah, there's a couple of Python ones. The problem is, if you use those, you have to be very careful that you don't accidentally pull in a module that does synchronous I/O, because then you know all of the paradigms kind of out the window. However, right. JavaScript didn't have a built-in how to do I/O, and to the extent that it did have any kind of paradigm like that, it was all done via asynchronous I/O because web browsers. So, so Ryan figured this would be a community that was open to it, and it was a language platform that was kind of didn't prevent it by having some other paradigm already in place. And so, around the same time, Google open sourced V8, and it was had a pretty nice interface to integrate with. So we decided to bind that with libev and libeio. And that just kind of caught on. I was in the middle of trying to figure out, like I said, in this server.js community, thinking about like ways to do server-side JavaScript, and then Node showed up, and a bunch of us, I think, were just like, oh, okay, this is it. This is the one that we should be doing. One of the problems, so I back in those days, in like mid 2009, the Node community was about a couple of dozen people on a mailing list. And every so often, and people were very excited and they were writing stuff and they were, you know, playing around with this new toy. And every so often people would, you know, share some module that they wrote and say, hey, I wrote this thing that connects to MySQL or, you know, caches requests or does whatever you could do with software. But the instructions for how to use it were always really convoluted and complicated. And they'd send it to this mailing list and say, oh, you know, go get clone this repository and copy this file over here and run make and do this thing and that thing. And it was just like, I was like, this is too hard. I'd previously worked at Yahoo. I was actually at Yahoo at the time when I was getting involved in all this. And there's a really great tool at Yahoo called Yinst, which I don't know how much NPM actually bears any resemblance to Yinst, but certainly the idea that you use a package manager in development, not just to deploy something, not just to sort of distribute it, was a big part of the motivation. I was like, I want to build things in Node, and it's too hard because I want to use everybody else's code. I don't want to build everything from scratch myself. So we need a better way to do this. So the first few iterations of NPM were essentially just taking what I was doing by hand and turning it into a little shell script I could run. The first registry was actually a Git repo full of JSON that it would download stuff from. That didn't last very long because that's a terrible pattern. It ends up being, when I say terrible, I mean it was a lot of work for me personally, and I don't like that.
No.
And it was kind of interesting, actually. I wasn't trying to really build a package manager per se. I wouldn't have said that was a thing I was going to do to, like, you know, strike out from fame and fortune. It was really just, I want to build websites. And in order to build websites, I have to have a web framework. And in order to have a web framework, I have to have components. And those components, I have to have a way to get them. Well, okay, I guess we need a package manager. So I started doing that. We over time that started to become a really popular thing. I went around sending pull requests to a bunch of different repos to add package.json files to everybody's little module. I mean, we're talking like dozens of things, where it was like the entire package community at that time. So by today's standards, it was a rounding error. So then the big kind of aha moment for me was when I started seeing people in the IRC channel telling other people to put package.json files. I was like, this is a person I've never met telling another person I've never met how to use NPM. This is like, holy wow, this is amazing. I ended up, I had been at Yahoo for 4 years. I actually ended up quitting my job for a couple of months just for a really like the first significant vacation of my professional career, and was able to sort of work on this thing full time. The first useful version of NPM that people were actually able to do much with was sort of like beginning of 2010, probably like spring of 2010. Later that year, I went to work with Ryan on Node.js at Joyent. I think I lost track of the question that you were asking. So,
it's been great having you on the show.
That's
almost
how it started.
Out of time. So no, just kidding. No, that was a great long answer. Although I do want to interject. When you mentioned Yinst, all sorts of my old neurons fired and said, "Oh, wait a second! I helped make some changes to Yinst when I was working on Panama, because we had to figure out how to have Yinst be templated depending on the install environment that it was in." And so I helped. I worked with the guys up in Santa Clara to actually work on that. But I was down in Burbank, so yeah. So I was cool. I was on Panama for about 9 months. So that was back in the day. So I think I want to back up one more step, though. I think almost all of our audience is familiar with the concept of client-side JavaScripts, things that run in their browser to make their browser smarter. But what can you talk more about what server-side JavaScript would be for and be about?
So server-side JavaScript is really for all of the same things that you would write any server-side or command line program to do. It sort of hits a similar niche to, Ruby or Java or Python or Go or any of the others. And it has some pros and cons. I know. I mean, I'm not going to say one thing is inherently better in all cases than another. But there's certainly some things it's very good for. The language has really good support for strings, and it's a good glue language. It's easy to kind of get up and running and get stuff done.
And so you're using JavaScript basically to write full server-side applications. And then one of the aspects of Node is that it can essentially look like it's multi-processing, but it's not really multi-processing, is it? Can you talk more about cooperative multitasking?
Sure. So Node actually has a single thread where it runs all JavaScript. And this it turns out, has some benefits over having to sort of manage your own threads. I'm not going to say, like I said, I'm not going to say threads are bad. All software is good for something. But what it does is, if you have even if you have multiple asynchronous things, the callbacks. Each time a callback is running, you don't have to worry about something else kind of interjecting midway in between two statements or something. So it enables you to write code in a very straightforward way, because you don't have to be juggling mutexes and locks and that kind of thing. The other interesting thing, I mean, you mentioned about how most people are familiar with client-side code, and it's tempting to think of NPM as primarily a Node thing, just because that's kind of where its origin story starts. But the overwhelming majority of packages on the NPM registry are not really Node related at all. The growth is primarily being driven by so many people putting their front end packages into the NPM registry. So, you know, for example, you got platforms like React and Vue.js and Ember, and, you know, countless others that are that all of their modules are NPM packages. All of their the components that you use in React are NPM packages with a package.json and some JavaScript entry point. And there's also tools like Babel and Webpack and Browserify that take this sort of Node paradigm and then extend it into the browser world. So what's ended up happening is, rather than, you know, and part of the reason why there's such ridiculous exponential growth in the NPM registry is that you don't have to be using Node in order to use it. In fact, most applications are using NPM at this point simply because they have a front end. And the way that you get your tooling, the way that you compile your JavaScript, the way that you get reusable JavaScript modules all involves the NPM registry.
Okay, yeah, and actually we had a question from the chat room that was specifically about that, but I sort of answered what I thought, which is that I'm pretty sure NPM is written in Node, and therefore we have to have Node installed in order to have NPM, but after that it's just basically a library as far as the end user is concerned. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I think a lot of our users might think of themselves as NPM users in the same way you might think of yourself as a GitHub user. But the Node binary, like the Node runtime, is kind of just an implementation detail. They don't think of themselves as building a Node application, or even if they do, it's just kind of the last layer of their overall app. One thing that's been really fascinating to watch, you know, it sounds like you and I both have a history at Yahoo, and at least when I was there back in the mid 2000s. There was a pretty stark line between front-end engineering and back-end engineering. And the difference was, back-end engineers wrote PHP and front-end engineers wrote JavaScript and CSS. And the boundary was kind of this like split right at the HTTP layer.
Right.
And at this point, what we're seeing is a lot of applications, that boundary's actually just shifted back one step. So you still have a back-end team. They're still writing some other language like Java or PHP or .NET, what have you. But the front-end team is managing the templates and the template generation, and a lot of that stuff is in Node using something like React, which is running on the server as well as on the client. So it's kind of like the definition of front-end changed a little bit, but we're still primarily, JavaScript is still primarily for front-end developers. It's just some of those touch a little bit of Node from time to time.
Cool. And I do want to actually say that I sat on a panel with Brendan Eich, probably, well, it must be 99 or something. It was at a web dev conference down in New Orleans. And the very first statement he said when we opened up the mics was, "I'm sorry for optional semicolons." So I thought you might want to know that about the history of JavaScript. So okay.
Yeah,
so
he NPM, should have just made them not allowed. That would have been much better.
That would certainly have done it. So so NPM is providing me with all sorts of things. Now, if it wasn't that a friend of mine told me about something, or I discovered it by Googling on it, and then it says to run the NPM thing that fetches all the dependencies, how would I discover things in this NPM registry that might be of interest?
Well, we have a pretty nice website. It's we're working on improving it. We've relatively recently actually changed our search page, so it's much better. We borrowed a lot of we are using some of the open source work that's been done by the npms.io folks, and our plans are to enrich that even more, because one of the interesting things about running a package registry like this is that you're sort of sitting on this, this giant switchboard of all of the things that everybody's using, and you can sort of get information about which things are more popular, which things are more reliable, which things people are switching over to or switching off of, in a big aggregated sort of way. And we can also get information about, like, you know, what other modules are you using, and which ones would you maybe want to use instead or along with those things. And so our plans over the next couple of years are actually to take and make that search even better and improve the discovery process. Additionally, the website shows, you know, all of the readmes for all of the packages that get published, the published date, the person who published them. And you can use it to buy private modules or set up an organization so you can sort of manage things in teams.
Okay, and so NPM is like CPAN in the sense that anybody that wants to upload anything can do that. Does that mean that there's a wide variety of quality? And I mean, then the CPAN has some pretty great modules, some pretty bad ones too. Is that true about NPM as well?
Yeah, I think that was by design. I think that, like, you really can't have a system with if you say we're going to put a team of experts, right, a cabal of people who are going to restrict which things are allowed in, you know, they have to be good and they have to use a namespace that's discoverable and it has to have tests. What you end up with is just a module with nothing in it, or a repository with nothing in it. And I think that, like, there have been a bunch of package managers that have gone that route. Most of them are not used anymore because it's very difficult to scale that. However, if your goal is, you know, kind of like net quality, right, net utility, the best way to do it is just say, look, like, there's going to be a lot of garbage. It's fine. Occasionally, and in fact, more frequently than you might guess, one of those bits of stuff that somebody said, huh, this is a neat idea, let me just publish it and see if it's useful to anyone, will become very popular. Or will get a lot of attention and be something that is actually really valuable and really useful. And I think just sort of like facilitating the overall, it's been called like an innovation blizzard. That's actually the thing that makes a lot of good stuff come out of it. If you try too hard to keep the bad stuff out, you end up just keeping everything out.
And have you had any potential security breaches from this thing?
Yeah, there is a constant threat of spam and malware. I mean, we have policies that say you're not allowed to do that, obviously, and we reserve the right to delete anything that's bad for exactly that reason. There's a project called the Node Security Project, which actually is. They do some automated vetting of everything that gets published to the NPM registry. And they actually have some really interesting technology to do that. I don't want to I don't want to talk too much about it, but you should totally bring Adam Baldwin on the show to talk about it if you're interested. The other thing that we do is and part of what Node Security Project does is not just sort of vet for malware. They also check for classes of security vulnerabilities and not sanitizing code before you pass it to spawn or whatever, so that people can get hijacked that way. And they also routinely vet the explicitly sort of go through and analyze the top, I want to say 1,000 or 2,000 packages by popularity and downloads, so they can kind of get sort of preemptively go ahead of some of that stuff. One of the weirdest sorts of spam that we've seen is people publishing an empty package with a README that has like 1,000 times in a row. The package name is something like QuickBooks tech support phone number 1-800 blah, blah, blah. And in the README, there's like 1,000 links that are all QuickBooks tech support phone number in like various kind of iterations. It's some kind of, I don't know. I assume it's some kind of like link spam Google juice thing, so that people who search for QuickBooks tech support will go to this website instead of the actual QuickBooks site. Anyway, we automatically scan for and delete those, but you can either have a block that keeps people from using the thing, or you can accept that you're always going to be cleaning up litter. And that's just kind of part of the duty of what NPM Inc. does.
Okay. And I just want to actually share my personal experience with CPAN. We've only had really one malicious upload, and he didn't believe he was being malicious. He wanted to phone home whenever there was an install, so we could kind of keep track of where it's being installed, because the CPAN itself is too distributed to provide that sort of information. Except the way he phoned home, and I think you understand a bit of Perl, so I think you'll get this, is that he would connect to a URL and then eval whatever came out of it. And he had no idea why that would be even vaguely dangerous. First off, I can't bet what he's about to run. Second, what if his domain gets hijacked so that it's somebody else's code? So we finally got him to – actually was the first one they ever did the banhammer with on CPAN. So actually took all of his code off immediately, anything that used that. And then he slowly was able to be re-allowed to upload things again. young and naive. That's all I could say, young and naive. Well, I have a lot more questions. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say, JavaScripters in particular are a very interesting bunch. And I feel like they're, I'm talking about my own people. I can criticize a little bit. We kind of like poking at the edges of things. A lot of us, that's why we became web developers. That's why we got interested in JavaScript, because look, it's on every web page. You can do stuff with it. So occasionally we get stuff where somebody's like, reaches out to us, says, "Hey, I published this package that removes all your files and folders, and you just let me do it. Isn't that funny?" And we're like, "No, stop.
Not funny. Don't do that, please. Not even close." I believe also there was another package that was uploaded that actually announced when you did the make install that this could have deleted all your directories because you're running it as root. So, but it didn't actually do that. It was just a warning. So, that's really the only things I'm familiar with the CPAN. But anyway, we do have a lot more questions. I know Guillermo wants to jump in here, but I do have an important message to bring in before we do that, because this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by GoCD. GoCD is the on-premise open source continuous delivery server created by ThoughtWorks. With GoCD's comprehensive pipeline modeling, you can model complex workflows across multiple teams with ease. GoCD can easily configure dependencies for fast feedback and on-demand deployment with its parallel and sequential execution. It offers complete customization for your software's individual needs. GoCD's real power is in the visibility it provides over your end-to-end workflow, so you get complete control of and visibility into all your deployments across the organization. GoCD will perform tests written in most languages or frameworks. Their test reporting will tell you in exactly which change set and on which platform the test started breaking. You can compare content across any two arbitrary builds, making it invaluable when troubleshooting a broken pipeline. GoCD has extension points for which plugins can be created, and numerous plugins are available, or you can write your own. Say goodbye to deployment panic and hello to consistent, predictable deliveries. GoCD is open source that you can download and use for free. Discover the power of their pipelines at gocd.io/twit. That's gocd.io/twit. Commercial support and enterprise add-ons, including disaster recovery, are also available. And we thank GoCD for their support of Floss Weekly. And now, Guillermo, I think you had a question to ask?
Yeah, well, first off, I'm here too. Hey. Hi. Hi there.
I was hogging the mic. Hogging the mic.
Yeah, I know. No, it's fine. It's okay. You know, this has been a very educational show for me too. I only knew NPM as a, you know, package manager. And I haven't really used it much. Oddly enough, I actually, first time I used it was in, I went back to college to finish my degree recently. And they were using that to teach the students there how to program and everything. I can kind of see before, the first time I went to college, the first time back in the old days, we had Apache, you know, like the whole LAMP stack. But now, LAMP, and by LAMP I mean Perl, just in case.
Yes. Yeah.
The original LAMP. Yes. And then we switched over to, it seems everybody here, at least, and TJ switched over to Node.js and your package manager. But you know, I was looking at the website before the show, and I saw that you have services and features that you're offering people. And I see that you're also not just focused on open source, but you know, closed source software and having closed source packages in your service. But I'm not quite clear on how that works. What would be the difference between me just having my own private Git repo and sharing that with my developers?
The biggest difference is convenience, really. If you have a Git repo, and it's just one Git repo and you're sharing it with a small number of people, it's probably fine. If you have a dozen of those things that kind of depend on specific versions of one another, and you're sharing it with a team of 5 or 10 people, or you know, even a team of 3 or 4, you very quickly run into the same kinds of problems that led to creating NPM in the first place. Especially if these things are independently being iterated on and going through major version bumps and so on. So what we found is companies internally sort of have a similar shape to open source communities. If you think about it that way, you have multiple different teams that are working on things. And one of the principles of NPM is to actually reduce friction for people who are independently iterating on things by removing a lot of the need for them to communicate, which sounds kind of weird because we think communication's good and it's great and we should be communicating all the time. But also communication is kind of a cost. If I have to keep track of every single version of a dozen different things manually, I'm gonna kind of be overloaded and not be able to get anything else done. And I think that's actually a big part of the reason why in the kind of pre-Node, pre-NPM era of JavaScript, there were a lot of frameworks that tried to really do everything. So if you look at, jQuery is probably one of the most popular of those, but the same thing can be said of Dojo or YUI or, you know, a bunch of others. MooTools was another one. They all kind of had to answer every possible question, because the limit of the number of things that you can keep track of updating is approximately 1. And so I would be able to keep track of, okay, every time there's a new version of jQuery, I need to look for that. I need to get alerted about that, get an email about it, and go and, you know, painstakingly update all of our code to make sure that it uses the new version and not the old version. But if I have to do that with even 3 or 4 things, it's just not sustainable. And as a result, I'll end up just putting all of the code in my own application, put everything in one place, which is, you know, if you don't have that many things and you don't have that big of a team, it's fine. And what we see actually is most people don't use private packages for their application. They tend to, the switching point where people want to purchase the service that we offer, or, you know, one of our competitors, tends to be when they have multiple different things and when they have multiple people who are working on things in parallel. So if you have a team of, like I said, 4 or 5 people, you sort of hit this point where, you know, person 1 is working on this thing and person 2 is working on this other thing and person 3 is depending on the 2 things being mutually compatible, and doing that all with Git repos becomes really convoluted and complicated. It's sort of easy at first. It's sort of easier at first, but then after a couple revs and a couple iterations, it gets really prohibitively complicated. So switching to using NPM and being able to set version ranges and bump major versions to communicate breaking changes, it's a much more efficient way to structure teams of people working on software. Really, it always comes down to Conway's law. You know, that software will tend to mirror the team structures that built it. And if you make it easy for people to use small modules, then you'll tend to have more modular code. If you make it easy for people to iterate in parallel, they'll tend to iterate more and be able to kind of be safe in doing that. We actually have a couple of other things that lead to people wanting to buy our enterprise software product. That is, has all the same benefits of being able to use the same NPM tool for your proprietary code, but additionally, it appeals to folks who have some kind of either regulatory or just InfoSec requirements that everything stay in-house, or really big companies that have like a SAML or LDAP or whatever to manage their authorization and authentication. And what it does is it lets you use that same set of tools to identify people and give them access to things in order to manage your private code.
I do have a follow-up to this, but we have to give some love to the chat room here. And Isol is asking, what is the left pad incident?
What is the left pad incident? This is great. left pad incident is a great example of how regulation needs to follow and keep step with the size and shape of a community. And we kind of had a hiccup. So originally in NPM, if you publish something, you had the right to unpublish it, to remove it from the repository. Seems reasonable. You have right access to this thing. You should be able to delete it. However, nobody ever really did anything bad with that. It was fine. What happened was somebody got upset with us and decided to remove all of their packages from the NPM registry. They got upset with us over something that had nothing to do with LeftPad per se, but LeftPad was a package that they had published. So they unpublished all of their packages, deleted them all. Unfortunately, LeftPad was used by Babel and I think something else. And even though LeftPad didn't have many dependencies, Babel does. And Babel is used in a lot of people's build steps. So when they deleted LeftPad from the registry, what that did was it broke a bunch of people's builds because Babel could no longer install since its dependency on LeftPad would return a 404 error. So we did some things to alleviate the immediate situation and also updated our policies moving forward. The first was we put LeftPad back. It was actually only gone for I think like less than 24 hours. And about 1,000 builds were broken as a result. So it was, it caused more like angst, I think, than actual damage, which is typically the case. The other thing that led to a lot of people getting, kind of grabbing onto this story is that LeftPad is like 11 lines of code. So the idea that somebody could, with this tiny, tiny little thing, they broke the whole internet because NPM was kind of the lead for the story, right? And that's a very compelling and like exciting thing to make a headline about. I'm not trying to diminish it. Like, we had the wrong policy in place. We shouldn't have let people delete stuff from the registry. So currently, if you publish something to the NPM registry, you have 24 hours to delete it. The thought being that the first day that you publish something, probably not that many folks are depending upon it. If something's been up there for more than 24 hours, you won't be allowed to delete it unless if you have some extenuating circumstance, you reach out to support and we'll, look at it. Occasionally someone will accidentally publish some, private keys or server credentials or something. And they'll reach out to us and be like, "Hey, I did this thing yesterday. It's been more than 24 hours. Can you please delete it for me?" And in those kinds of cases, we do generally, accept their request. But if it's just, I publish this thing and I don't like it anymore. And yeah, I know 100 people are depending upon it, but they shouldn't. Like, well, that's kind of not okay to ruin their builds. So, we just tell them, thank you, but no, thank you. Here are some ways you can deprecate it so that they get a notice that they should upgrade or whatever. the thing that is kind of interesting when I say that, like, you know, and this is kind of a general Floss kind of takeaway here, is that in any community, there is some amount of social mores, right? There is a general understanding of what kind of behavior is okay and what kind of behavior isn't. And when a community is very small, that's enough, right? Like, there's a general understanding that, like, you shouldn't smash my car windshield. Even if you really don't like my car, you're not allowed to smash my windshield. Even if I've said something mean about your mother, like, still can't smash my car windshield. And if it's just 10 people, yeah, nobody's windshield is going to get smashed. But if you're living in a city, you kind of need some kind of, you know, prevention for that, right? You need a garage that keeps your car protected when you're not looking at it. You need, you know, people who are going to call the police or report something. You need insurance companies for, in case that happens, I can be compensated. And so, all of this kind of like complexity and elaboration and bureaucracy and more advanced rules kind of come out of that, just to kind of keep a society functioning. And I think a Floss community is a very similar kind of thing. It's a similar kind of animal. You need, you know, policies, and some of those policies just being like, hey, this is the rule and here's how we're going to enforce it. Other policies actually being encapsulated in software, like, you know, returning a 400 error if you try to delete something. And I'm sure that as NPM and JavaScript continues to grow, like, we'll continue to have to keep updating those things. Yeah, that's Leftpad in a nutshell. It's been, the other interesting thing about it is it's been, over a year now since that happened. And a lot of folks still don't know that you can't unpublish packages. Like, this has been the rule for over a year now. And we still get people saying, like, well, yeah, but what if somebody deletes something? It's like, well, they can't. Like, huh. Look, try it. It won't work. Yeah, I think that shocked a lot of people. It was a big blow to our community, and it's something that I think we've recovered from, and the trust in NPM was restored. But something like that never really comes off your conscience. You know, it's like the thing in Ruby Gems where somebody proved that they could use the YAML parser to gain access to the server. Like, I'm sure they still hear about that. It's like, they fixed it. They fixed it fast. No damage was done. And additional rules were put in place to prevent people from doing this thing, which previously just everybody was kind of polite enough not to do. And I think that that's just sort of a natural part of growing up as an open source community.
You know, it's funny that you mentioned that. I once you started telling the story, I remember seeing this all over my RSS feeds. So it did actually blow up really, really big, I suppose. I wasn't aware you're not allowed to delete packages anymore. Is there a way for you to actually trace back which packages depend on others? And if nobody depends on it, you'll just allow them to, you know, get deleted even if it's past 24 hours?
It's difficult for us to tell. So we can definitely say whether or not any other NPM package depends on something, right? That's trivial. That's in our database. However, what we can't say is whether or not anybody's build will break if you delete this thing. So your application, which you haven't published, might depend on your, you know, 11-line module. We can sort of get at that somewhat by looking at the download counts. But we have so many bots that constantly mirror the registry that, like, everything gets downloaded 100 times. So yeah, generally, we at that point, you really need a human being with a human brain to, look at the evidence and see what we can see and sort of make a judgment call. If it's a private package, for example, then okay, we know that, you know, who has access to this thing because you've either granted them access or you haven't. If it's something that's in your organization, then we can, you know, generally comply with it. But for like open source unscoped packages, yeah, we generally don't allow it unless there's, like I said, some kind of really extenuating circumstance that makes it less harmful to delete it than to leave it there.
We have a couple questions in the chat room. We want to make sure we get to those because we're sort of getting out of time here. So sure. Esol and Jay Bennett both ask roughly the same question, which is there any license requirements for things that end up in the NPM registry?
There's not. By publishing something into the NPM registry, we do have a terms of service that says you give us the right to distribute it. So you can publish something to the NPM registry that says no one may use this ever. You can't distribute it. You can't give it to anybody. it's not allowed. But here's the thing. Like, we're still going to let people download it. We're still going to distribute it. You published it into the registry. The only reason to do that is so that we can distribute it. So, we like I said, we have a terms of service that says you give us the right to host and distribute this thing. We don't assert the right to use it. We don't assert the right to profit from it, do anything like that. But we do definitely kind of have to have the right to publish it, to distribute anything you publish, because that's what we do. If you don't want us to do that, then don't publish it, because that's how a package manager works. Other than that, though, there are licenses ranging from proprietary, you know, you can't use this unless you pay us, all the way up to, you know, AGPL. You know, even if you use this in your website, your entire website has to be GPL. And I think the overwhelming majority of JavaScript is either, you know, some flavor of weak copyleft or non-copyleft open source license like MIT, BSD, or ISC. The community in general, I think, as open source communities go, tends to be less sort of copyleft GPL-y and more sort of, you know, capital O open source minded. A lot of JavaScript is used for commercial things. We, you know, it's a real working language for building stuff that people pay for. So I think a lot of folks just kind of find it easier to use MIT style licenses.
And speaking of licenses, if my research is correct, NPM is under a sort of unusual license. Can you describe what it was created under?
The NPM client itself is under the Artistic License 2.0. If you're both old Perlers, you're gonna recognize this one. The first few versions of NPM were actually under an MIT license, and I eventually switched to Artistic 2.0 for a couple of reasons. The first of those, and most things that we do, by the way, like almost all code that I write, almost all code that my company, that folks at my company write, we just release everything as ISC for the most part. NPM itself is released under Artistic 2.0 license primarily to prevent redistributors from disabling or modifying features that then we have to support, because people will come to us and say, hey, this thing's not working. And we look at it and we're like, well, it works for me. And they're like, oh, I installed it via you know, some other system package manager, and now it doesn't work because they modified something and they are still calling it NPM.
Yeah, I know. That's one of the really nice things. And also Artistic 2 has been pretty much vetted by the Perl Foundation's lawyers. So it's got some legal standing as well, at least as best we can do without actually testing it in court. A couple more real quick questions. And like I said, we're almost out of time. One of the things that is interesting, and this is more of a Node.js question now, is that JavaScript stuff used to get into callback hell, and then this notion of promises and streams were introduced into the language. Has that found its way into Node.js, and if so, also to a lot of the NPM packages?
Promises are really a nice approach to asynchrony, I think. And especially, I think it's worth mentioning, Node 8 is going to be coming out with a version of V8 that supports asynchronous async functions and also the await keyword. So await basically is a keyword you can put in your code that says wait for this promise to resolve and then proceed down to the rest of the function. And async functions always return a promise, and you can use await inside of an async function. So this is kind of a very technical way to say promises are like first-class citizens, and you can, for the most part, just kind of ignore them. You don't really have to like create them or touch them. They're sort of buried in the syntax of the language in a really elegant way. It's unfortunate that I still have to write code that supports Node version 4 and 6, or I would be mm-hmm. using async await everywhere. It's especially nice in writing tests because they can just be very like look very nice kind of top to bottom. As far as Node's internals, Node Core, there's Node itself is a platform, and so it needs to be very conservative about what kinds of things it changes and what kinds of things it breaks, because people are using it for real stuff, and it's really not a good idea to say, oh, hey, new version of Node, good news, you've got to rewrite all your programs. That doesn't make anyone happy.
No.
And someday Node may try to do that. A lot of platforms do. It's usually not a great idea. Sometimes in the fullness of time, it turns out to be worthwhile. But I mean, people are still using Python 2 and Perl 5. So I recommend against it personally. And what that means is all of the callback stuff in Node will probably still be callback stuff, at least if me making noise about it can have an impact. New things may be added to have promises as a little bit more first-class citizens, and I think that there's definitely some pressure to do that, but it's tricky to get it done in a way that's really elegant and also doesn't break things. The other thing I wanted to say about callback hell is arrow functions actually make that a lot nicer.
Yes.
Because they're just a lighter syntax, and if you're just doing a thing that just returns a value, then you don't even need the curly braces. I've been really, really loving that in my own recreational coding projects, and generally getting away from the function keyword entirely. It's just a very heavy, blunt instrument, and arrow functions are a lot nicer.
Yeah, I noticed Darts had a lot of that same similar pathway too. And in fact, I'm sure they're working directly with the ECMAScript people to try to make Dart at least have some similar concepts. So they introduced async and await, I think about a year ago, into the language. So definitely have some overlaps with that. And actually, speaking of Dart, are you familiar with Dart's pub? Because it seems to be awfully inspired by what NPM does.
I've heard quite a bit about it, but I don't use Dart ever. I'm sure it's great. All languages are great. There's just only so many hours in the day to play with stuff, and I tend to stay focused on JavaScript. We do use a lot of Rust here, and at NPM, basically anything that really needs to get optimized for speed will tend to get rewritten in Rust, which is a great language. It's kind of, as I look at Rust, it's kind of what I wish C++ had been, if that makes any sense. It's kind of like a better successor to C. And Rust has a package manager called Cargo, which is also really nice, got good things to say about it. I've heard good things about Pub. People have said it's like NPM for Dart, which I assume they mean as a compliment, and I feel complimented by it as well. So,
yeah, it does a lot of really cool things. And I don't know enough NPM to be able to compare it. I know Pub fairly well now, but I don't know NPM very well. One last thing. We were talking about the left padding thing. I remember the left pad. Somebody created left pad as a service, so you could actually just call an API call to get a left pad. That was crazy, all back then. Okay, hey, so we're almost done. I've got a couple more questions to ask you, and then we need to wrap up. Is there anything I haven't asked that we should have covered in the show?
Oh, probably we should talk about NPM 5 briefly. This is going to be coming out really soon. It's NPM 5 is going to be bundled with Node 8. There will be lots of announcements talking about it very shortly. In the next couple months. It hasn't been released yet, but NPM 5 has been in beta for a couple of weeks now. There are still, I think, just a quickly reducing list of things that need to be fixed with it, but it is ridiculously fast. It's more reliable. It has a brand new cache implementation, which is kind of a big part of that. I think people will really like it. I've been using it myself. It's nice.
The one thing I was also going to interject, and I forgot because I didn't write down my notes, is I'm really sort of starting to hate typing things in JSON, and I was wondering if I could start nudging you into maybe actually making it be possible to do the same data in YAML, which is a superset of JSON, so it wouldn't matter. You can always call the YAML parser, and it just works. Is that something you might consider in the future?
There are some thoughts around that, giving us a way to providing a way to have an extensible thing that generates your package.json, and then the package itself, the tarball itself, would still have a JSON file. You just wouldn't have to type it yourself. There's a oh gosh, I'm blanking on the name. There is a package that does this so that you can have a package.coffee as your package document, and it just sort of immediately before publishing, it just turns it into JSON for you. Yeah, I think something like that may get first class support in NPM at some point. Already as it stands, you shouldn't have to type into your package.json that often. For most things, NPM init and install --save is kind of what you need.
That works. Okay, last two questions. So I think I can already guess the answer to this one. What's your favorite scripting language?
My favorite scripting language? I guess by default, I'd probably say JavaScript, but Bash is a close second.
Okay, that'll work. And but here's the one I wouldn't know the answer to. So what's your what text editor do you spend your time in all day?
Vim.
Vim. Okay, not an Emacs. Not even. Yeah. Shut up, Guillermo. Shut up.
I lost that one again. Sides here.
Oh no, it's a well. If you've seen previous shows, of course, I'm a Perl and Emacs guy, and all of a sudden it's like nobody's saying either of those answers for anybody in the last 5 years. I've been asking these questions. Anyway, hey Isaac, it's been wonderful having you on the show. We could have gone another hour easily. There's so much more I'm curious about, but obviously people can find you on the website and all the usual spots, and we'll put all the links in our show notes for that. Thanks for coming on and talking about NPM and Node.js.
Thanks for having me.
Awesome. That was Isaac Schulter. Well, I hope that was closer. Talking to us about the topics I just mentioned. Guillermo, what do you think?
This is one of the projects that I don't usually, use because I don't really write that much JavaScript unless I, really have to, especially server-side JavaScript. But it is something that I know a lot of people who do use it a lot. So this may actually be interesting for a few people that I know locally. So I'll probably have to bring that up at a meeting or something.
Yeah, well, as I've been exploring, of course, more Dart and more actually SPAs and being able to be smart about that. And I was studying AngularJS for a while, but I've sort of abandoned that because I'm more interested in doing Angular Dart and spending all my time learning that instead. I've been typing NPM more and more often, and so I keep seeing this as being, this is a way to build this project, this is a way to install this thing. And so NPM is becoming much more critical in so many much more or more workflows, and it's, I think it's because, again, there's this critical volume of packages available, and it's just kind of a paradigm. In fact, there's too many. There's like 16 ways, I think, to do something that looks like make. So I'm kind of – I didn't have time to ask him about that. But, I mean, it's just – it's starting to be like, okay, let's have a – let's have the winner here finally. Grunt, gulp, whatever all those things are, Bower. There's too many things out there to do exactly the same thing. I don't want to have to learn them all, at least with make files, it was just make. So much simpler that way. Anyway, I could talk about that all day, but I don't have all day. We're running short of time here on the Twit Network. So I'm going to go ahead and run down who we've got coming up next week. Faraday RF, which is digital radio networking using the 33-centimeter amateur band. It'll be fun. I believe Jonathan Bennett, who is a frequent co-host, has got that one tagged because he likes that stuff. Pelosa, which is a distributed bitmap index for massive data sets. Magento, which is a commerce platform, e-commerce platform similar to what we used to call shopping carts, but way out there, way doing cool things. I'm really excited about the next one, Flutter, which is building fast cross-platform mobile applications in Dart. And this has got a lot more traction, especially since Google I.O. just happened last week. They talked a lot about Flutter, a lot about doing a lot of things there. Cockpit, which is administering your Linux system via the web. Think Webmin, but on steroids. I'll just use that two or three times today. Just added to the schedule, though, Redis. I can't believe we haven't had Redis on this show yet. It's the most popular key-value store in all of open source software, and so we've got some key people and valuable people. That's so stupid. Coming on the show to talk about that. Following that, Brian Millendorf is going to talk to us about Hyperledger, which is the Linux Foundation's collection of projects to do blockchain technology. Jenkins, which of course is the leading CI/CD server, a fork of Hudson. We're going to talk about all that. Just added since last week, we have Container Ship. I saw them at, I think it was OSCON, or maybe it was Red Hat Summit. And they're a cross-platform, it was at OSCON, a cross-platform way to deploy and manage containers. So similar to Kubernetes that we had on a couple weeks ago, but from a different perspective. Also just added to the schedule. In fact, just minutes before I started this show, LibreOffice has gone a long way in 5 years. We had talked to them 5 years ago, but apparently all sorts of new things to talk about. So LibreOffice is going to be coming on our show to talk about that. That means I've got bookings all the way up for about almost 2.5 months, 3 months now. It's really nice that I went to OSCON and Red Hat Summit because that helped me fill out quite a bit of my schedule. So you can find out all these names and more and what the schedule looks like at twit.tv/floss. That's our homepage for our show. From there, you get the big spreadsheet linked in there to tell you about things. If you have any of suggestions, again, please tell the project leader or the community coordinator to email me, merlin@stonehenge.com. My name is, in fact, on there. My email address is on there. Not my name. My name's probably on there, too. Whatever. So we do, we can always make more slots. There's only a couple slots open right now, but we can always make more. I just type question marks in the spreadsheet, and that's how simple it is. I'm going to check my own schedule to make sure I'm okay and available for those. We have a live stream. We took some questions from there. That's at 9:30 a.m. Pacific time, and it's been on Tuesdays for, I think, 5 years, 4 years, something like that, at live.twit.tv. But starting June 28th, we will be moving to Wednesdays. That's a permanent move all the way to Wednesday because they need the slot Tuesday for other things. You can follow us on Floss Weekly on Google Plus and on @FlossWeekly on Twitter. You can follow me at Randall L. Schwartz on Google Plus, and that tweets over to Merlin, M-A-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter. I'll be at the Pro Conference in D.C. area, probably, I think it's in 3 weeks, 4 weeks, somewhere in there. Then I'll be at DragonCon in September talking about Dart and talking about other things on the EFF track they have there. And I'm also going to be at the allthingsopen.org conference coming up in mid-October. In the Research Triangle area, and I took that one on partially because I had never been to the Research Triangle before. I needed to check off a few more pins of cities I've been to and states I've been to. I think I've been close to there before, but just never actually in the Research Triangle. Okay, that's it for me. Guillermo, what do you have to plug today?
Okay, so I guess people can follow me on Twitter. I am Guillermo Amaral on there, at G-A-M-A-R-A-L, or Gamaral for short. And I have a YouTube account. You can also just Google my name, get that name over there, and just search for that. It's all, I also have a link in Twitter that you can click on that to find me. And I will be in BitCon next month, just in case, in the LA area, just in case somebody wants to meet up. You can also tweet me on there. That's it. I don't really have that much. I'm not like Randall. You know, he has to go on and on about this. I only have like two things.
Yeah, well, you know, part of keeping this show alive and keeping the rest of my business alive is I have to go to a fair number of conferences every year. And that's just part of the expense of being me. Anyway, Guillermo, thank you. I know. I get to meet cool people like you face to face. It's really fun. Okay. So we're out of time. So thanks, Guillermo, for joining me once again. And we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.